Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode, a conversation with Dean Susan Fournier, where she answers the question at the heart of the show.
From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. It often feels like society, the global community, even we as individuals, are hurtling towards a future we may not like. Will artificial intelligence slip our grasp and turn on us? Is climate change past the point of no return? Well, we can see pretty clearly the looming challenges, but why can't we get it together to do something about it? Well, my guest today says we can. We've done it in the past, she says, but it takes imagination. And she's got a big list of ideas on how all of society can take control today to plan for tomorrow. So this hour on Point, an optimist and her recipe for the future. And you can join us. How are you feeling these days? Optimistic or pessimistic about our future? Maybe just a dead center realist. And do you think humans are capable of getting together to solve the big challenges we see ahead of us when so much of our actions are determined by what's needed right now? Join us online anytime on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Well, joining us from Washington is Beena Venkatraman. She teaches in the program on science, technology, and society at MIT. She was also a senior advisor for climate change innovation in the Obama White House. And she has a new book out. It's called The Optimist's Telescope, Thinking Ahead in a Reckless Age. And we have an excerpt of that at onpointradio.org. Beena, welcome to On Point.
Thanks so much, Meghna. I'm so glad to be here.
So first, let me ask you, do you feel optimistic about our collective future as human beings?
Well, it depends what you mean by optimistic. I'm the kind of optimist that looks at our situation today, and I do see a lot of signs of despair. I see threats on the horizon, whether you look at the state of our politics and the divisiveness in American society, British society, around the world, inequality, or you look at the state of our planet and the warming temperatures, the warmest July on record this year. I see those problems. But what I also see, having done 5 years of research spanning all kinds of fields, being all over the world, is that we have a choice when it comes to thinking about the future, that we actually are not condemned to the sort of short-sightedness we see rampant in our societies, that we have the possibility to act like better ancestors and act on our own behalves for the sake of our own futures.
We have a choice. Okay, I want to talk with you about what prevents us from making those choices. But before we get there, Beena, can you tell us a little bit about your own experience, for example, in the Obama White House that might have led you to think maybe we have to sort of rethink how we even conceive of our futures?
It was my job in the Obama White House to engage with community leaders, mayors, business leaders, and to help them try to understand the predictions of climate change, so the threats of droughts and floods and wildfires that we could be expecting in the future. And this was in 2013 and 2014. And of course, since then, we've seen the Camp wildfire in California, severe droughts throughout the world. We've seen floods, severe hurricanes like Dorian we just experienced in the last month. And when I was sharing these predictions, often I would find myself sitting across from leaders who would say, you know, I really care about these threats of the future. I actually have children or I have grandchildren. I'm even concerned about them from the perspective of the bottom line of my business. Once I was across from a food company executive at the White House at a conference table, and he looked me dead in the eyes and he said, yeah, you know, I'd really like to do something about this. I can see that it's going to affect the supply chain for our products, that there are going to be all these droughts and floods. But my board and my shareholders are really focused on my quarterly results, and I just can't think ahead. And when I would share my frustration facing this obstacle constantly, it was like the roadblock, no matter which route I took on the highway, I would sometimes hear people say back to me, well, that's just human nature. Mm. It's just in human nature to be short-sighted. And when I left government, being a former journalist, I started to interrogate that very assumption.
Interesting. I mean, it is a commonly held that human beings are terrible at really predicting the future value of things. Are you saying that that's not true?
Well, it's true to an extent. And it goes back, this insight, to Plato and his dialogue Protagoras in 380 BC, where he talked about how we were pretty bad at sort of calculating future future pleasure or future folly. And it's sort of been echoed throughout the ages by different kinds of thinkers, economists, neuroscientists, philosophers, telling us that one reason that we experience so much dissatisfaction and regret is that we have trouble bringing the future into focus. But that's not to say it's impossible for us. And in fact, humans are the only species that seem to imagine the future, to be able to project ourselves into future scenarios and then make decisions to sort of shape that future. It's the reason we put human beings on Mars. It's the reason we built great cathedrals over centuries. It's the reason we have civilization and we have agriculture. We are able to project ourselves into the future. And that's not to say it's easy. And I do think that we're living in a time where the needs have never been greater for humanity to think ahead, whether that's looking at our lifespans. We're living way longer than our grandparents. For most of human history, 7,000 generations, humans lived till about age 40. And now human lifespans in the developed world are poised to extend past a century. And it's also true when you think about the knowledge and power we have to shape the future of the planet at scale. We are currently engineering the climate of the planet that people will inhabit 100 years from now, 200 years from now. That requires a new level of foresight. It requires us to expand our imaginations and, frankly, also our institutions to be able to plan for the future and think about futures that we have not yet experienced in our own lifetimes.
Okay, so about climate, which is one of the biggest challenges right now, especially, it's a challenge in reality regarding the environment, regarding, you know, the future of humanity. But it's also this psychological challenge about, can we accurately imagine ourselves into the future? And the UN Climate Summit's going on right now. And so, Bina, I just want to play a couple of things for you from Greta Thunberg, of course, the 16-year-old climate activist who spoke at the Climate Action Summit. And here's one clip. She said that young people like her actually need adults to create their own hope, not pass it off or not put that burden on future generations.
This is all wrong. I shouldn't be up here. I should be back in school on the other side of the ocean. Yet you all come to us young people for hope. How dare you?
Bina, I'm wondering what you thought about that.
What Greta Thunberg is giving us is a gift. It is a voice from the future. She is presenting us with a choice, and being more than double her age, I agree with her. We can't ask the young generation to whom we're leaving this planet, to whom we're leaving the legacy of the Industrial Revolution and our emissions that are warming the planet, we can't ask them to give us the hope. And frankly, I'm not asking anyone to engage in armchair hope. What I'm asking for is an engaged kind of optimism, a sense of vision and imagination of how the future could be better, and then action, using our political power as adults, using our organizing power, using our leadership wherever we have that influence, in order to listen to her call. And I think there are aspirations among all of us. If you talk to almost any person, whether they have children or not, whether they have grandchildren or not, I don't have children, but they care a lot about future generations. And that aspiration is actually reflected in the founding documents of democracies. Edmund Burke, the godfather of conservatism, the Irish political philosopher, wrote in 1790 about society being a partnership among generations. The public trust doctrine occurs in democratic constitutions around the world. So this aspiration is both personal, but it's also political. It's part of what we see ourselves doing. We see ourselves as being good ancestors, leaving benefits and resources and options to future generations. And yet we're not acting that way today. And what Greta is doing, I believe, is helping us inhabit our imaginations about the future that we are leaving behind, bringing that into the present for us with urgency so that we might actually answer that call.
Well, so here's a little more of what she said.
How dare you pretend that this can be solved with just business as usual and some technical solutions? With today's emissions levels, that remaining CO2 budget will be entirely gone within less than 8.5 years. There will not be any solutions or plans presented in line with these figures here today, because these numbers are too uncomfortable and you are still not mature enough to tell it like it is. You are failing us.
Greta Thunberg at the UN Climate Summit in New York. So, Bina, peer through the optimist's telescope regarding our climate future. I mean, Greta there was talking about the present path that we're on. What kind of psychological or political changes do we need to make, structural changes, to imagine a different future?
Well, I think the changes are required at sort of every scale, from the individual all the way up through our businesses and capital markets to our communities and our societies, and really holding our political leaders accountable for action on this issue. And it's going to be a sustained response that is required for this problem, because it is a problem and a crisis that's going to unfold over the course of generations. So while we're talking about the need for urgent change now and the call for that that's being made by youth, not just Greta, by the way, all around the world, there were more than 4 million people who participated in the climate strikes on Friday. And so we have to see this as a broad scale political and social movement, which is asking, really demanding of our political leaders and business leaders that they take more aggressive action on climate change today. But if you think about what's required to do that, what's required is for us to be able to sustain our interest and our motivation to be engaged in not just reducing emissions that are contributing to the warming of the planet, but also preparing for unprecedented change in our communities, coastal areas that are going to flood, perhaps the need to move, perhaps the need to change what we eat because certain foods aren't going to be available. There's going to be a large amount of change, even within the span of, I would say, my lifetime, because of the warming planet. And so at that individual level, part of what I call for are exercises in, for example, what I would think of as imaginative empathy. So writing a letter to yourself to be open 50 years in the future, or to a child or niece or nephew or godkid, and having that be an exercise and trying to inhabit that future as you imagine it, to clarify what the choices are in the present that can lead us to different kinds of outcomes. So if you want to imagine a better future, and if you can dare to do that, what are the things that have to change in both your actions and in society to make that happen? Clarifying that there is a path out of this despair. Because I think one thing that happens when people think about the future, if they just get sort of doomsday prophecies about refugee crises or other harms, they tend to turn off. They don't feel like they have any agency to do anything.
Well, we are talking this hour with Beena Venkatraman. Sorry about that, Beena. She's the author of the new book, The Optimist Telescope, Thinking Ahead in a Reckless Age, and how we can change how we think individually and as a society to really tackle the challenges of our present for a brighter future. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. These days, it's hard to ignore the debate over the role business should play in society.
There's crescendo around profit, period. Is profit bad? Is capitalism evil? These themes are out there.
Is this criticism of business warranted? And if so, how do we fix it? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode of the Is Business Broken podcast.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour with Beena Venkatraman. She is author of the new book, The Optimist's Telescope, Thinking Ahead in a Reckless Age. What individual tools, what organizational approaches, how can we change society as a whole to better imagine the future that we want and then work towards it? That's the guide that Beena provides us in her new book, The Optimist Telescope. And by the way, we have an excerpt of it at onpointradio.org. And Beena, let me just get a couple of calls in here right off the bat. Ross is calling from Des Moines, Iowa. Ross, you're on the air.
Hey, yeah. So I'm 22. I live in Des Moines. And I think most people in my generation are pretty clear on the big ideas we need. You know we need a Green New Deal. We know we need to get rid of fossil fuels. And what we really need is to bridge the gap of the difference in power between us and huge fossil fuel executives. That's why I think groups like the Sunrise Movement are so important. but we need a generational movement of young people taking power in our community to put the ideas we already have into law.
Well, Ross, thank you so much for your call. So, Bina, what Ross's comment makes me think about, he said, you know, a generational movement to take power, to lead on these big issues. But at this point in time, and, you know, we're seeing that movement emerge for sure over the past couple of years. But at this point in time, you know, I was thinking about what you said during the before the break about as individuals thinking more about your future self, writing a letter to your future self to shape your mind, to consider future impacts of your present actions, which is all well and good. But you can completely understand why some people feel powerless and wonder about the utility or the futility of doing things like that on an individual level, when perhaps the people who really need to be writing to their future selves, you know, the most powerful amongst us on planet Earth, aren't necessarily thinking about what the impact their actions are going to have even 5 years down the line.
Well, the two aren't mutually exclusive, and in fact, they're mutually reinforcing. The more that we make the future salient in our day-to-day lives, the more we're going to make it a priority. So even though people will say they care about the future or care about climate change, are they really thinking about it when they go to vote? Or are they thinking about the near-term boost in the stock market because that's what they're observing? And on a daily basis, right, we have so much input and we have what cognitive scientists call an availability bias or what the filmmaker Wim Wenders calls the monopoly of the visible, where we're looking at the data points that are right in front of us, particularly in this information age. We're doing that more than ever. And we're not necessarily bringing into focus those aspirational values that we have for the future when we go to the polls, when we think about using our power. I was so struck by the Amazon employees who did a walkout and preemptively Jeff Bezos of Amazon announced an ambitious renewable energy and carbon neutral plan before that walkout, knowing that his employees were basically demanding more aggressive action on the part of the company on climate change. Well, it takes being able to make the future a priority to be able to do actions like that. And I do think Ross is right in the sense that there are a lot of young people right now that I talk to and engage with, my students and beyond, who are very much in despair or organized and in despair, I should say. They're sort of engaged optimists around this problem. And whether it's the Sunrise Movement or the climate strikers or others, they're being engaged on this issue. And what they need is for the older generations to make their issues and issues of the future more of a priority. And that's not to say that the individual action is the only way this happens, but in a time where we need to actually change our political regime in order to respond to multiple issues of both present and future, and we only had 58% of the electorate voting in this country in 2016, I think it's important to talk about individual action as the way that mechanism for achieving political change and holding our leaders accountable. That said, I also think that there are
institutional... Actually, can I just jump in there for a second?
Yeah.
Because I think this is a really important point. Absolutely, especially in a democracy, if we have a huge chunk of society not actively participating, that's going to be perpetually a problem. But I think for a lot of people, one of the reasons why they don't actively participate is they don't see evidence, positive evidence of what happens when they do, right? Like even when they vote, they feel like the outcome didn't make any difference in terms of not just who got elected, but the policies that got enacted. So there's a present bias that's generated by ample evidence, current evidence of the inefficacy of voting.
Well, I think that's true to some extent, but I think we also have to recognize that elections do have consequences. And for example, right now in Massachusetts, Senator Markey is being challenged he'll be challenged in the Democratic primary. And Senator Markey is one of the co-authors of the Green New Deal resolution, which the caller mentioned. And what you have to look at is that certain political leaders are able to lean more forward on this issue of climate change or on other issues of the future, whether that's investing in biomedical research or being concerned about national debt. And that those leaders are able to actually affect change. And we have to observe the ways in which those changes are affected by our politics. In the Northeast, the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative, for example, has achieved major reductions in emissions that contribute to greenhouse gases, to global warming. Mm-hmm. But that wouldn't have been possible had you elected political leaders in all of those states, those northeastern states, that didn't want to act on climate change and didn't want to change the electricity sector or were bought off by the utility sector. So I think that it is a time where we can feel that the corruption in Washington or campaign finance, for example, is a major barrier to getting what we want done when we vote. And that remains true, and it remains a barrier. But that's not to say we don't have power. I would say that the larger the collective, right, the more we act, the more power we have. So this idea that we somehow turn away from because we don't see enough impact, we stop acting, right? It doesn't make any sense at all. In fact, the sane, rational response to not seeing the outcomes you want is to organize more, mm-hmm. right? It's to infect others with the enthusiasm to value these issues right. and to value the future.
So, you do talk about other major challenges in your book, like gene editing and things like that. We'll get to that in a second. But this climate one is so urgent right now. And given your experience in the White House, Bina, I wonder, just honestly tell me something. The Obama administration had a couple of very meaningful climate initiatives. I'm thinking of the Clean Power Plan that came out of the Obama EPA. But if we're going to be ruthlessly honest about political inaction on climate, what did you see inside the Obama White House that gave you pause? Because I'm thinking, you know, here, even with a president who ostensibly was climate aware, if I can just put it that way, the administration never chose to really push hard on things like carbon pricing or carbon cap and trade. I mean, these are things, major steps forward that they could have taken that they chose not to. So were they looking through a political pessimist telescope?
I think there was a bit of lack of ambition around the climate agenda initially. And if you look at the first term when Waxman-Markey, which was a carbon pricing piece of broad-based legislation that was being pushed through, was being proposed and being negotiated, there was, I think, a lack of sufficient leadership and vision around getting that accomplished. And there was a prioritization of the health care, mm-hmm. Of Obamacare. And of course, then losing the Congress, losing the majority in Congress going into the second term, that was the point at which I joined the administration and also the point at which the President Obama made climate change a major priority of his administration. But by then, you didn't really have as much of the political capital to move legislation through Congress. And it's arguable whether there's more that could have been done vis-a-vis Congress or whether it really made sense to just focus on executive action. That said, a significant amount was accomplished. But I do think, part of the challenge here is that these issues have been thought of as issues of the future. They've been thought of as issues that can be deferred. And really, when you look at our values, look at what people say they care about their kids more than anything else, right? They say they care about the future, but then there's this mismatch between our aspirations and what we actually do in practice. And one of the reasons I wrote the book is because I believe that is not because human nature is just cursed to be this short-sighted. It's because we actually are making choices. And we have to start acknowledging that we're choosing to prioritize the present. And we're doing that by the way we design our institutions, our environments, and the cultural norms that we accept, and that there are examples of how we can actually shift that, both in politics, but in the practice of our lives or in our communities. And if we don't choose to do that, then we can talk about whether we really believe in these values. But I think we first need to expose those choices.
Right. Well, so let's talk more about some of the specific things that you brought up in your book about sort of how to change the way or shape the way we think about the future. You visited a virtual reality lab at Stanford. What was that all about?
It was great. So for one, I got to see myself as a blonde, which was new for me. And as an old man in a business suit and kind of commanding a lot of attention. So these were virtual reality avatars that I inhabited and was able to sort of experience myself in different characters. And the idea behind those experiments in particular is trying to help you be empathetic towards a different kind of person than the sort of body that you inhabit on a day-to-day basis. And something similar to that, by the way, was used by a researcher named Hal Hirschfield, who is at UCLA, an economist, who was trying to help college students save more for their own future. And he found that having them interact with virtual reality avatars of themselves in old age would allow them to see what the future could be like, care more about their future selves, and commit to making more savings and to saving in a more concentrated, regular basis. But one thing that I did when I was at Stanford in the virtual reality lab is I swam in a coral reef. So I swam in a coral reef that was much like the reefs of today, or let's say 20 years ago, vibrant, colorful fish, just felt blissful to be underwater like that. And then the reef flashed forward to the year 2100, which, if we're on the current course and the oceans continue to warm and acidify because of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere that's being fixed in the ocean, we will see coral reefs die like this. And the whole idea behind this experiment is to help you feel the future. Imagine it, but also inhabit it in your body, because the experience of virtual reality can give you some of what's known as haptic feedback, different kinds of feedback in your body that can actually make you feel like you've had the emotions of inhabiting that future experience. And
what did you feel when you did this?
I felt the tragedy of it. I felt it in my guts. And I think I felt it not just in a cognitive analytical way, which is the way I'd understood the threats of ocean acidification to coral reefs, but I really felt it. And I think not everyone's going to get the chance to swim in the Great Barrier Reef. And these kinds of technologies might actually have the opportunity to help us bridge that imagination gap. Because what we know from the cognitive science is that people can get predictions of the future. They can be told a hurricane's coming their way. They can be told that, someone's going to break their heart. They can be told something very robust, a prediction of an earthquake. And yet, if they can't imagine it because it lies outside of their experience or because they can't vividly summon the colorful details of that prediction, they won't act. And so what we need are some of these bridges, some of these tools that help us inhabit those futures and make them more real for us.
But Bina, it makes me wonder, I mean, doesn't it depend on the kind of future that's being presented in these experiences, that if it's too dire, I mean, kind of linking back to what we're talking about regarding how we discuss climate change even right now, could it render people to feel even more powerless?
Absolutely. What psychologists told me time and again as I was researching this book over 5 years was that there's a clear balance. When you're presenting doomsday scenarios of the future, if you present those to people sort of on an ongoing basis, or even just in a situation where you tell someone, you know, the world's going to end in an isolated basis, you can often see that the result of that is that people will feel a sense of despair. They might even choose to value what's happening right here and now even more. There's a line in Margaret Atwood's The Year of the Flood that if you tell people they can do nothing, they'll do worse than that. And I think that's sort of true. That holds true in the science as well, that people need to feel a sense of agency, a sense of an ability to change the future for better or worse. And the reality is that we do have choices, and some of those choices can be enacted individually. Some require more collective action. But if you can highlight for people and showing them the future, what the sort of decision tree is, what happens if we do this? What happens if we do Y? What happens if we do X? That allows them to clarify the choices they have and allows them to better engage with those futures as opposed to just burying their heads in the sand.
So you're about to become the editorial page editor for the Boston Globe. Congratulations on the new job, by the way.
Thanks so much.
But it makes me wonder, I mean, the media has a major role to play when it comes to, you know, being a force, not the force, but a force in helping shape this collective imagination about the future. It seems, based on what you're saying, it seems as if the media, and we'll include ourselves here, is utterly failing at that job then.
Well, I think it depends where you look. I think right now the emphasis is a lot on following the trends. And because we have a president in this country who is tweeting a lot of his sort of announcements and his decisions around foreign policy, his decisions around domestic policy, his decisions around personnel, who he's firing or who's in the doghouse, right? There's a sort of sense that the news is being made in these very small increments and that we have to track and we have to focus on each of these increments, each of these tweets, right? And I think that there is an obligation because of what we know about how that incremental news can focus our attention on just what's immediate media and not on these sort of long-term trends. What's happening, right? We're at historic levels of inequality in this country. What's happening to the planet? Are we observing these long-term trends? And when we're constantly looking at the noise, it becomes really difficult to observe those trends. So I do think as stewards of these media institutions, as people who are responsible for helping to educate the public and inform the public about issues of the future, we need to be also helping them to focus on what are the big structural issues? What are the big, sorry, I feel like I'm paraphrasing Elizabeth Warren with that one, but almost unintentionally, she's infected my brain. But I do think there's a need to help people understand what's happening in terms of long-term trends and to focus on what's meaningful. So there's a balance between, you know, trying to make sure you're covering the news as it happens, and I'm sure you feel this, Meghna, and I'd love to hear your thoughts
on dear.
It, that you know, you want to be giving people the information of the day, but not neglecting what's really important, what can make meaningful change. So as I think about leading the editorial board of the Boston Globe, we can editorialize on everything egregious that the administration does on a daily basis or on, every piece of news that comes out. But we might be missing big opportunities to hold our institutions accountable for more meaningful aspects of how they're changing American life or how our policy is being eroded. For example, how we're basically falling into debt because we're subsidizing people to live in floodplains, right? These are things that I think it's our obligation as media leaders to really be focused on.
Do you really want to know what I think, Bina?
Yeah, I do.
You're about to get me in trouble with a couple of million people here. But look, I have formed an extreme allergy to covering the news simply because it has happened. And my question always to myself is, what can we do that brings deeper value and understanding for folks as they individually are trying to grapple with our ever-changing world? And do we always hit that mark? I don't know. But I actually don't think, I mean, to your point that you write about in the book, I don't think there's much utility for the future if we're spinning constantly around little tiny headlines all the time. And that if we're going to have better tools to advance as a society, we need to understand what's happening. So that's what I aim for. Don't know if I always hit it, but we got to take a break. Thank goodness. We'll be right back. We're talking with Bina Venkatraman. Her new book is The Optimist's Telescope. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour with Bina Venkatraman. She is the author of a new book, The Optimist's Telescope, Thinking Ahead in a Reckless Age. And we have an excerpt of Bina's book at our website, onpointradio.org. Let's go to Donald, who's calling from Fairfield, Iowa. Donald, you're on the air.
Hi, Meghna. Hi, Bina. Great to be on with you guys. I just wanted to talk briefly about the country of Costa Rica. This is a country that's actually leading the world in cutting their carbon emissions, and it's set to go fully carbon neutral by next year. Some people talk about how the Green New Deal here in the U.S. is controversial and unrealistic, but Costa Rica is actually an example of a country that already has a version of that bill passed in their government, and it's working. They're actually pulling themselves out of third world status by investing in conservation and education. So I just wanted to let you guys know about that, and I'll take my comments off the air.
Donald, thank you for your call. Let's go to John, who's calling from Omaha, Nebraska. John, you're on the air.
Thanks for taking my call. I remember y'all mentioning data a couple minutes ago, and something occurred to me. We don't have any data. I mean, we as in like the general populace, the great unwashed out here, we have data. We could, something we might be able to do is get the data to the people. It exists, but we care about the stock market. You see it every day. Those numbers are on chyrons all day long. And it's in the evening news. It's in the newspaper. They have data. We could generate our own data and put it in an article in a paper.
John, are you talking about data on climate change?
Well, data, local data, for one thing, because that's where people will feel they can make a difference.
Okay. Well, John, thank you for your call. So Bina, we'll respond to what John's saying, that more local data about issues that might matter to folks could help. What do you think about that?
I love this idea. And in fact, it's one of the things I worked on in the Obama administration was trying to widen our view of what climate data are so that what people observe in terms of change in blooming seasons in your garden, for example, or the day that the leaves turn in, you know, New England, that those kinds of information should be seen as part of the picture, as part of how we observe the changing of our planet. And I think what John's bringing up is so important, which is that what we measure becomes what we focus on, it becomes what we reward, it becomes what we do. And that's true whether you're looking at business leaders and how they're measuring their quarterly profits, or us and whether we're measuring the number of steps we took or whether we're observing, right, the stock market dips, the ebbs and flows. So I think it is really important for us to be observing these long-term trends and long-term change, and that it requires looking at data in perspective, not just incrementally. And there are efforts actually around the country, one that I know of called IC Change. There are citizen science initiatives around the country that are trying to engage more people in this process of collecting data. And also, to the point about Costa Rica, I think what's really powerful and important about this point raised by the caller is that there's an art of the possible that is proved by these examples. Now, people will say Costa Rica is a much less complex country than the United States, which is so diverse and so large. The economy is much larger. All of these things are true, of course. But what's important is that we have a vision of how we want to move our society. And when people talk about the cost of the Green New Deal or of ideas to transform our economy towards less carbon emissions and towards doing better on climate change, what they're often neglecting are the costs of inaction. Mm-hmm. So they'll talk about the cost, but there's like something like a 7-to-1 cost in a new study that's been put out in terms of the actual impacts of climate change on our economy and the way it'll destroy financial institutions, the way it'll destroy the basis for supply chains for major companies around the country and around the world, in fact. And so what I think is happening here, and this is one of the things I address in the book, in the last chapter of the book, in fact, is that we're discounting those future impacts. Yeah. We're not bringing them into sharp enough focus in our economics, in our investment, in our insurance policies. And that needs to change. And what part of what I provide in the book is a roadmap for how those institutions and businesses can do that.
Well, so this is a really important point because, as you know, there's a huge body of research around human beings and how bad we are at really predicting the future value of things, this discounting problem. I mean, you kind of take us through a thought experiment. And let's do that here on the show where you ask, this is actually even kind of hard to say out loud, but would you kill a billion people in 100 years or one person today? Now, what was the purpose of asking that question?
Well, when you apply a discount rate, and by the way, we do this at a personal level when we say, you know what, I'd much rather have $10 today than $20 next week for whatever reasons. My values are that I need the $10 today. I'm not really willing to wait. You know, maybe I have a cancer diagnosis and I don't know if I'm going to make it to next week. So those kinds of decisions we make at the individual level to discount, they make a little bit more sense to me, though we do tend to discount too much, hyperbolically, as economists would say. But when we do this collectively, that's when it's really kind of criminal, because what we're doing is deciding as a society that we matter today more than people in the future. And that thought experiment is basically a way of presenting to us the current practice of social discounting, which is to say that with a positive discount rate, which means that we consider the future to be less valuable than people today. And there's some degree to which that's reasonable because we don't know many, 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 many thousands of years from now an asteroid could destroy the Earth. But to a large extent, human societies, right, that are going to exist 100 years from now, 200 years from now, are we willing to really say that we accept widespread suffering or death for them? And when we apply the discount rate, we're implicitly saying that without actually knowing we're saying it. And those decisions are being made by policymakers on a regular basis using what's known as the social discount rate to make those decisions. And my point of raising that is really to present an alternate way of thinking about what we value most. And I talk about a family heirloom that I received from my great-grandfather, who was a music and art critic in India, which is this beautiful instrument called a dilruba, which I play horribly, which I'm still learning. And the way in which I view this object, which is that it's irreplaceable, right? If someone stole it from my house today, I would not be able to replace it with any amount of money. And that's true about societies. It's true about communities. If you take all of the water, fresh water out of an aquifer, if you destroy an entire fishery, if you destroy the climate as we know it, which supports our forests, which supports our clean air that we breathe, it supports our health, that's not replaceable by capital. And so you can't use a discount rate to say that if we just accumulate enough capital in the stock market or with bonds, that we can replace these irreplaceable resources. So I'm advocating for and sort of giving a sense of how we can move towards more of a system of creating shared heirlooms, which involve identifying what are those irreplaceable resources in a community or in a society that we need to set up our policy, our institutions, and our funding to protect over time and to shepherd across generations. And I think that's really the way we become better ancestors, is not to know the future perfectly, not even to imagine it perfectly, but to be able and willing to shepherd what we most care about to the next generation.
Would that be the way to overcome what maybe, I mean, aren't we as humans somewhat hardwired to be sort of present tense thinkers above all? I mean, there's all sorts of theories about why, scarcity, that kind of thing. So creating more collective heirlooms, as you're talking about, could overcome that hardwiring?
I think it can. And while we do have that component of our personalities and of our nature that is focused on the present or can be focused on the present, we also have this capacity for mental time travel, where we use our memories of the past to project ourselves in the future, where we care for the young, where we actually live through our grandchildren's lifespans, part of them in many cases, and we care for them, right? The purpose of that, the care that goes into that, that we see all around us, right? That doesn't explain, right? That doesn't sort of coincide. There's sort of a mismatch between how we're acting and how that care manifests and how our moral systems and our systems of values really think about the future and future generations. And yes, it's difficult to do alone, but that's why we have communities. That's why we have society. They help us discourage violence. They help us regulate currency. We don't do that alone, right? We don't trade and barter goods alone. In some societies, they might still do that. But for the most part, we rely on institutions, laws, policies, cultural norms, businesses, groups of people to help us do what's difficult to do alone. And that's where I think we have the greatest opportunity for change. And frankly, we face the greatest failure. But my skepticism about where we are right now, I really don't feel is a source of cynicism about that, because I've seen these examples of how it can be done. Just to give you a quick example of this, you know, there are fisheries, which you hear about fisheries around the world, just fishing until the entire stock collapses. Well, I spent some time with a fishery in Mexico, on the Pacific coast of Mexico, for example, a lobster fishery, where they're actually treating their lobster like a shared heirloom, stewarding it carefully to the next generation, carefully policing their fishery, measuring their catch. Another one in the Gulf of Mexico for commercial red snapper, which brought that species back from the brink of extinction, where the fishermen have organized themselves as long-term shareholders. In complement with government policy, these businesses are actually acting for the sake of the future. So when people say it's inevitable that there's always going to be a tragedy of the commons, you only have to look farther. You have to look at these examples and show that there is a precedent for humans organizing to do things on this for the sake of the future. So we have to start treating this not like it's an inevitability. We have to treat it like it's a choice.
Ah, well, let's go to Jim, who's calling from Frederick, Maryland. Jim, you're on the air.
Yes, thank you for taking my call. Yeah, I have a question for Vina and you, Magna. I know you're well studied on many issues. So I'm a member of a local cooperative, an organic food cooperative in Frederick, Maryland, and we have almost 7,000 members now. So the idea of cooperatives like this food co-op, solar cooperatives, and others organizing in cooperation. So cooperation among cooperatives seems very intriguing to me. For instance, you know, when the people, so a cooperative, by the way, is when the users or the workers of the organization have ownership in the enterprise.
Mm-hmm.
And when that happens, people are more concerned about things other than the bottom line. For instance, what community would allow its streams to be polluted for the sake of profit?
Right.
So I'd like you both to comment about this new way of thinking about economics, taking the power away from the big corporations and putting it locally. We'd have to have this all over, but in the power of local cooperatives cooperating amongst themselves.
Right. Well, Jim, yeah, thank you so much for your call. And Bina, I'll let you take that. What do you think?
Well, in fact, the example I just talked about, the fishermen on the Pacific coast of Mexico and the Baja Peninsula that I spent some time with are, in fact, organized in cooperatives across 9 different communities. And the cooperatives together, they form a federation, to be a little wonky about this. And what they're doing is very much at the local level. They are self-policing. It's not the Mexican government that's been policing their fishery. In fact, they're doing it collaboratively across the communities. And there's something about that local control and the trust that they've built at the local level that I think does contribute to their ability to sort of be able to have with confidence, if I'm not going to fish too much, I know that the person in the next town is not going to be fishing too much. And I can rely on that because there's some continuity between us and there's an understanding between us. And you can go to the next person's town and talk to them about an issue that might arise and managing that. So I do think it can be an important way, a decentralized way of dealing with protecting resources for the future. And I tend to think of these as shared heirlooms or heirloom economies. That said, I don't think we should give up on sort of the larger institutions and our larger markets where the economies are really not operating in these kind of localized ways. I think they still also need to be oriented more towards the future and that there are mechanisms to get them to do that as well, whether it's getting stock, you know, instituting changes in how stock holding time works so that shareholders and major corporations are being taxed if they don't hold on to their shares long enough to actually influence the long-term direction of companies, or, for example, to have institutions that enforce shared heirlooms like the National Park System, which invests in and protects areas of land across the U.S. that are then shepherded across generations and where there's a sense of cultural value to these iconic places and they're being protected.
Well, in the last couple of minutes we have, Bina, I was wondering if you might consider previous moments in history as good examples of ways to address our collective future now. For example, I'm thinking of the civil rights movement, right? A movement of people both at the national and grassroots level who were pushing back against centuries of political and structural barriers to their equality. It seemed very hopeless at times, for sure. But at the same time, there was this message, this imagination for a better future that, you know, you talked earlier about how do you sustain motivations for change? Is that a good historical example of ways both individually and collectively to move forward towards a common goal?
I think it is. One of the real characters I interviewed in the book is Marshall Ganz, who is a sociologist at Harvard, but also was on the front lines of major social movements of the 20th century. So Marshall was an undergraduate at Harvard and dropped out during Mississippi's Freedom Summer to register black people to vote in Mississippi. And he got involved in that movement, the U.S. Civil Rights Movement, and then in the United Farm Workers Movement as a strategist to Cesar Chavez. And he studied social movements across history. And one of the things he shared with me, which really captivated me and really sort of spoke to your question, is that there was not a guarantee of success. There was not a sense that this was going to work. There was actually a lot of despair around the U.S. civil rights movement. And there was a sense that there was a future that could be concrete, was an imagined future that was shared by a lot of activists and leaders in the movement, a future where kids could go to school with kids of different races, a future where people could sit at the same lunch counters, ride the same parts of the bus, and that these really concrete visions and imaginations of a better future, not just resistance of the present, but actually a vision of a better future, much like what the Sunrise Movement is putting forward today around climate change, or what other movements are doing in other contexts, that is a motivating force in the present that can help us keep going.
Well, Bina Venkatraman, her new book is The Optimist's Telescope, Thinking Ahead in a Reckless Age, and we have an excerpt of it at onpointradio.org. Bina, it's been great to talk with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Meghna. It's been a pleasure.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes featuring Susan Fournier, Alan Questrom Professor, and Dean.
So let's start this conversation with the title of the show, Is Business Broken? It's a provocative title and a question. Where did this come from? Why that question now?
We're in a big cultural moment where capitalism, business, market systems are really being scrutinized and debated, and the role of business with it. So I think the question is just on the table. It's on people's minds. It's in the news media. It's in conversations. I think there are growing voices, loud voices, especially among young people who seem increasingly to believe that business and maybe capitalism with it are harmful and create rather than solve problems for society. And what we do seem to hear are those loud voices, and they are very black and white. There are protagonists and the antagonists and the pros and the cons, and there's really no middle discussion. It's sort of like people for and against, and it's loud.
Right. For and against DEI, for instance, right? A battle at play.
Right.
The way you describe it and the way you describe the polarization, it makes it feel like very much of the digital age, right? It feels very much of today. Some of those arguments have been around, though, right? Is this criticism of business and this question, is business broken, is that a new question?
You are so right. It is not a new question. Schumpeter, he was a professor at Harvard, and he's also maybe one of the most influential political economists of the early 20th century. He called for the death of capitalism, the death of business, 100 years ago.
Okay. Wow.
And when he critiqued way back then, he said the very successes of capitalism would bring about its downfall because it would create values hostile to capitalism, and that this would particularly take hold among intellectuals who were critiquing. So there's a lot of that same kind of dynamic happening today, and that's 100 years old. But yeah, we've seen this kind of cultural fervor playbook many times in the past, often precipitated by big crises.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.